So it is Christmas Eve. I am a convert from the Catholic faith. So once upon a time, I would have been, having a disco nap and getting my suit on to go out to midnight mass and the long vigil.
Playing from desktop 5D0JM90.
Wow. And so I was just reflecting today on a bit on what it feels like to have converted to Buddhism a long time ago now. Over 30 some years I've been in this faith most of my adult life. I left the Catholic Church when I was about 15. I dropped out of my confirmation program. I didn't want to be confirmed. And so I remain unconfirmed. And I remember the feeling of coming into Buddhist temples in the early years of my becoming connected to the Dhamma, and feeling this mysterious sense of being at home, and that the spaces they felt strangely similar and completely different from the churches that I had grown up in and around, and the feeling that I was used to having in Christian churches. But I remember also, as I entered into meditation practice, longer retreat, having a sense that particularly in the form of the loving kindness practice, and the universal directionality of the loving kindness practice, this way that metta demands that we wrestle with what it might mean to love unconditionally and to love in a kind of universal way, beyond borders and distinctions and across difference, and across the preferences of the self and my personality and my social role. It was only after doing this practice did it start to open in me some sense that this feeling may have been what what the teachings of Jesus were pointing toward. And like many folks who find the Dhamma kind of in recovery from what in my case wasn't really a trauma, but it was definitely a not feeling not attuned to or resonated by the Christian church. For others, clearly much more traumatizing, much more difficult. Coming around to a way that I could appreciate the person of Jesus and the teachings that came through in a very different light, by seeing them as an expression of metta, of loving kindness, of compassion, and especially compassion in action for the poor, for the oppressed, for the dispossessed. Earlier this year, I was talking a bit about the Buddha, and we did this whole reflection on the Buddha as a clairvoyant, that you know, many of the great founders of faiths, you know, have some kind of signature supernormal power that they demonstrate, some kind of miracle that they perform. And so the Buddha's power is vision. The texts talk again and again about his clairvoyance, and that he can, you know, he can see heavenly beings, he can reach out with the divine eye and see beings in different places, he can see where people are reborn, so he can track the progress of the momentum of karma between bodies, which is very mysterious, how to see that. And so this is his, you know, signature skill, and it's the thing that characterizes his awakening. So when the Buddha awakens, what he does in the descriptions in the Pali Canon is that he first directs his attention to seeing and understanding his past lives, and then he directs his inner eye with his clairvoyance to seeing the arising and passing of other beings and how they arise and pass based on their actions, their karma. And it was only through thinking about this sense that the Buddha, as you know, as our great founder teacher, was a visionary in the clairvoyant sense. I thought at one point, what during that, you know, well, what was Jesus, you know, and then remembering back to all of the stories, and really feeling Jesus as a healer. As a healer, and in a way, as a divine, you know, social revolutionary, in the ways, in some ways, not dissimilar to how the Buddha flouted the social regulations of his time. The Buddha, you know, for instance, in dismissing caste as having any reality to it, and making it legally irrelevant in the Sangha. This was a socially radical thing that the Buddha did. And of course, admitting women into the Sangha was socially radical, denying class entirely as a basis for hierarchy in the Sangha. All of these were radical on the part of the Buddha. And in a similar way, really, in terms of class, Jesus's radicalism in, you know, the people that he hung out with, the people that became his disciples, and his power of healing, that he healed people, you know, maybe even, you know, raising Lazarus from the dead. He, you know, healed the blind and the disabled in various ways. And so I think, like a lot of people, coming to a faith that resonated for my heart had the result of healing in a certain way a kind of bitterness I had toward faiths in general and toward the Christian faith. But it remains true for me that there's a kind of that there's a kind of strangeness to, you know, converting to Buddhism from not just from having been Catholic myself, but in the, you know, immersed in what is still very much a Christian culture here, as in many parts of the world, and less so here in you know, Northern California, where I live, which is almost resolutely animist, secular, pagan, Unitarian something, you know. But much of the rest of the country is very staunchly Christian, and you know, even in ways and with belief systems that are, you know, that are shocking to you know, coastal seculars. Sometimes when we hear, if you hear about, you know, end times theology and, you know, some folks expressing Christianity through their politics, not for the reasons that progressives think, that like, oh, we approve of these policies or those policies, but because, you know, there are large numbers of people right now who believe that we are in the early or middling stages of a war between Christ and Satan that will end the world. So this is a belief that is current, you know, that is not medieval, or that feels medieval but is quite current in contemporary America, driving politics and, you know, driving policy in some places. And so encouraging us to feel into what it's like to be connected to the Dhamma in the United States, North America. We're not all in the United States here, but in North America here, where we are, both the US and Canada, largely, but not entirely at all, Christian, but having a very strong Christian force in it. And of course, this being Christmas Eve, you know, being the structure of our year being held by the Christian holidays. The Buddha built his Sangha by converting folks from other faiths, right? Buddhism, unlike Hinduism, for instance, is not a religion of local animist-type deities in the way that in many parts of Hindu South Asia, there's still very much a connection to, you know, the spirit or, you know, or deity of a particular mountain or river or valley, or of course the deities precious to individual families. That the Buddha's Dhamma, the Buddha didn't say that those deities, by the way, didn't exist or even were unimportant. And in several occasions, he encouraged folks to maintain their family traditions. There's almost a way that the Dhamma that the Buddha teaches, as expressed in the early text in the Pali Canon, is not so much a religion at all, but a thing that you can do from any background. And it doesn't deny the truths of other religions as much as operate in a different register from them. So you could continue to, you know, propitiate and make sacrifices to nonviolent ones, of course, once you've, you know, taken refuge, not killing animals to make your sacrifices, but making, you know, offerings to the deities that protect your family, that protect your town, your community, in the same way that you always have, in a way that that, you know, that you might say that, you know, I have the practice of meditation and accepting things as they are and letting go. And that's my meditation. I sit in meditation. I do this practice of setting down the stories, setting down even the constriction of the self, coming to states of mind that are more wide open in order to see everything change and unfold and, you know, to see the insights that are core to the Dhamma. This is core to my practice. And then, you know, I go out and I weed the garden and make sure things are watered and plant the right seeds at the right time. And I do the work. I go to work and I make money and I pay my rent and, you know, do all of the things. I don't abandon the world around me, the people around me, my responsibilities, because I've fallen in love with this radical view of letting go, you know, that the Buddha teaches. In the same way, you know, honoring your family's deities or the local land spirits is a kind of maintenance of relationship and ecosystem that is not in conflict at all with practices of deep letting go and seeing impermanence and letting go of the constrictions of the fixated self. So Buddhism doesn't actually ask, the Buddha didn't ask folks to convert per se. The people who really changed their practices were the monastics, you know, certainly, who who would like give up fire sacrifice and come and be, you know, to come and be monastics with the Buddha, you know, or householders who would give up, you know, animal killing sacrifices in favor of sacrificing, you know, precious substances non-violently, offering only, you know, ghee and milk and precious things like that into the fire rather than the bodies of animals. And so there's all these places where the Buddha says, you know, keep, you know, don't drop your family's traditions to come to this practice. So that's one side. You know, you don't need to convert. And when I first came to particularly insight meditation, there was a lot of talk in the insight world in the, I presume through the early days, but certainly when I arrived in the kind of mid-late 90s and early aughts, there was a lot of talk around not converting. A lot of folks were saying, you know, like my teacher Jack would say, you know, don't become a Buddhist. You'll just annoy everybody. Become a Buddha. So, you know, don't take on another identification, but free the heart. And I know what he meant by that. But it was actually really important for me in that period to kind of bow to what my teacher was saying, but not actually do that. And to say, actually, this faith has become one of the most important things in my life. I honor it tremendously, and I feel so much gratitude for the cultures that preserved it and continue to preserve it. You know, this is absolutely my home team, and I'm wearing the jersey. You know, I'm totally Buddhist, and it has felt much more right to do that than to say that I'm not, based on an idea about, you know, doctrines of non-identification or something like that. And so I think that, you know, the thing the Buddha was proposing, like maintain your family's traditions, you don't need to, you know, do something else in order to practice. That instruction I can feel in what Jack was saying, you know, don't become a Buddhist, become a Buddha. And at the same time, living in a Christian culture, I can feel the ways that Christianity shapes the underlying worldview of you know, the water I swim in here. It's, you know, the way that the assumptions of the Christian world formed our entire country, are baked into our constitution, are baked into our civic structures, you know, and are deep in the worldviews that many of us carry. This idea that is very much not an indigenous idea, it's very much a Christian idea, that world history is moving toward a final calamity, and then there will be an end. That history is a finite experience that begins with creation, before which there was nothing, and then there's a historical period from the fall from Eden, through which, you know, famously the English, you know, theologian Bishop Usher said was like 6,000 years ago, which is way too short, but, you know, there you go. That's what he said. The world is 6,000 years. He added up all the genealogies in the Bible, which, you know, is literally true. And so then he goes, okay, well, Methuselah lived for, you know, 900 and whatever years, and King David lived for this many years. And he adds it all up and, you know, comes up with the conclusion that the world is 6,000 years old. And so however you do that math, however the Christian world did that math at different times, there's a beginning. And the theology in Christianity depends on the myth. It depends on the primordial, you know, Eden and the fall and the beginning of time, and and this, you know, it was, you know, struggle from then on, and it was historical, and there was, you know, all of the histories recounted, and then we get to the present, and at some point there's going to be an end, a great war that ends things. And how this idea is in everything, you know, how this idea colors evolution, even as evolution destroyed the idea that everything was created out of whole cloth 6,000 years ago. And, you know, this famous line that is attributed to Martin Luther King, but he was actually quoting a white Protestant preacher from the mid-19th century, that the bending of the arc of history toward justice, you know, this idea that is inspiring and motivates much of our social change work, you know, the idea that there is a progress toward betterment, toward improvement, you know, toward justice. I think it's an important and powerful and necessary feeling to find that it's possible to improve things. And clearly, in so many ways, things have improved. So this is a sensible interpretation of history. If you look back and you read histories full of wars and torment, and maybe there's a bit less war and torment right now, you could come to this understanding. But I think it's helpful to really frame it historically as a Christian idea. And to say, you know, as someone inspired by the teachings of the Buddha, how do I relate to Christian ideas of linear history, or Christian ideas of you know, a battle between good and evil, or things, you know, accelerating toward a great final battle? We've talked a lot at various times about, you know, communicating wisely with relatives who have different political views. And this is a common topic in, you know, well-meaning Dharma circles nowadays. Here in California, lots of us have, you know, relatives in less progressive places, or with you know, more conservative or reactionary views. But we talk a lot in progressive culture about how to relate with people who have different political views. But I hear very little conversation, actually, about how to relate to people who have different religious views, when those religious views are really substantially different. And, you know, it's not like most people think about theology. I sort of wish they did. I sort of pretend I live in a world where I could go to my, you know, conservative in-laws in Kentucky and be like, no, really, you guys, let's talk about, you know, the teleology of the end times. And, you know, we're not having those conversations. But I want us to feel, in a way, what it's like for view. This is really a reflection on view, to evolve, and how it's very difficult to have conversations across differing views, and particularly views that we would call, you know, religious or theological. To be inspired by the teachings of the Buddha means, you know, wrestling with ideas like rebirth, means wrestling with ideas of karma that are very different from, you know, Christian ideas about sin and judgment and forgiveness and redemption. To wrestle with ideas about the nature of ourselves, whether or not we carry, you know, eternal souls that are judged for our actions, and how we engage in a practice that demands that we wrestle with these ideas while immersed in a culture that that holds very, very different ideas than that, very different views than that. And so there's a mindset and a kind of practice, I think, that comes with being a convert. That there's for those of us who didn't grow up in Buddhism but came to it later, there's a process around view where we've come into, in many cases, very passionate connection with a body of ideas based in a culture that originally is very distant from the one, you know, that many of us grew up in, if we're converts, if we weren't raised in this faith. And there's, you know, sometimes conversion happens in the kind of classic dramatic, you know, way, right? You have a powerful experience of something and you know it's true and it's you know, unshakable from that point. But for many of us, it's a much slower process of encountering something that feels right, you know, encountering the Four Noble Truths. And this is many folks' conversion story I've heard again and again. You know, I came to, you know, to a Dhamma talk and the teacher said, look, this is where it starts. Things are painful. There is suffering. It's just true, you know. And being hit by this, that like finally someone was just telling me the truth, you know, wasn't veiling it in a kind of mysticism or coming out with the explanation before the symptom, you know. In Buddhism, very beautifully, the Four Noble Truths starts with the symptom, not the cause. You know, it's not you're a sinner, therefore da da da. It's like let's start at the ground level. It hurts. And then it says, and there's a reason why it hurts, you know, and it's possible for it to stop hurting. And so for many of us, there's an encounter with one of these fundamental proposals, like the Four Noble Truths. And then as we engage with that, and we're drawn in to study and practice, we begin to soak in the culture of the Dhamma more. I think there can be layers where the view implied in these teachings begins to seep, begins to soak into the heart, soak into the deeper layers of our identity, of who we think we are, how we think about the world. And as that happens, it will occasionally, or inevitably, eventually, I think, come up against very set or firm or sometimes rigid or painful layers of, you know, culture, of trauma, and of deep view, right? Like the view that everything is improving, especially if we help it along, you know. And this is just not a Buddhist view, but when we run up against layers of view, you know, or the idea that I'm a sinner, you know, like that my soul is flawed in some way. Is a view. It's a Christian view that I might not even think I hold. You know, I might really think like, oh yeah, I'm so glad I'm done with that church that told me I was flawed from the very beginning. And then somewhere deep in my practice, you know, I'm doing loving kindness practice and I can't send it to myself. And I'm just like, oh, I try, and I'm like, oh, I just can't find compassion or love for this one here. And if I feel into that, you know, feeling into that at one point, I found, you know, original sin tucked away in there, inherited from, you know, a couple millennia of you know, one millennia at least of, you know, Christian ancestors and my own upbringing here and the culture I live in. And to really understand that the process of conversion takes time, and it's and I don't even know if conversion is the right word. I think that might be a startling or you know, a discomforting word for some folks, but the process of coming fully into refuge, I think, of really finding the refuge of the Dhamma as home, takes time, and it takes a different kind of process than if we were either born into the faith or how it is for, you know, folks who grow up in a Buddhist country or culture. One of the Westerners who went to Thailand and became a monk there, and in many cases, I think the one I'm quoting is still there actually, was talking about the Thai people at one point and said, you know, something about how, you know, how profoundly fortunate he could feel. He could feel the goodness of it being a Buddhist culture, and what a profoundly good karma it is to be born in a Buddhist culture, in a Dhamma culture. And this is, you know, this is a reflection from a convert. This is someone saying, I can feel the particular dukkha, the stress of trying to figure out how to embed the Dhamma in every strata of my being and come to a fullness of practice in this, you know, in the Buddha Sasana, and how the conditions of this life, you know, in some ways have made that possible. And there's so much gratitude for that, you know, gratitude for the transmission of the Dhamma to the West, gratitude for progressive California upbringing in the, you know, late 20th century that made it possible for me to be here at all in this way. And at the same time, a recognition of the heaviness of the conditions of, you know, trying to learn and hold to a strange but quite radical faith while immersed in a culture that doesn't support it. And so all of the mixtures of privilege and trauma that are there. And so on this Christmas Eve, then, I want to just end with a kind of prayer or blessing or wish. This is how it expresses in my own, you know, conversion process. That the growing culture of the Dhamma in the Americas, where I am, that it flourishes and grows and takes root so that it can be a more easeful and capacious and welcoming and robust and dynamic and, you know, culturally and socially and intellectually vibrant home for those who are drawn to its view. Broadly, this includes a wish that our, you know, that American culture remains and grows more so friendly to differing faiths, so that the experience of being not Christian in America is not one of fear and danger as it is for some folks. And in many places. And that those of us who have found the Dhamma coming from other faiths, or in this moment when the Dhamma is a minority faith in this country, that we are sustained in our exploration of the Dhamma, that we don't lose hope or lose the way or lose faith. That if this is a good place for our hearts and for our growth as beings on the path, that we find the conditions and the support to grow and deepen in the Dhamma as far as possible, even under these conditions that have both blessings and deep challenges. So, to my family and friends and greater culture, observing the Christian holiday, blessings to you in your faith, and may you be well and safe. And to all the Dhamma friends, may our foundation in the Dhamma be strong and supported by an ever growing, but by a hopefully growing and expanding and deepening Dhamma community here in the Americas and around the world. May the Dhamma of the Buddha grow and sustain for a long time. So, all right. And setting that down, prayer of a convert. So we'll have a few. I'm curious. Any reflections on any of this? On conversion? On culture? On loving kindness? Maybe as the bridge between these faiths.